The woman is... what? Did it matter? The woman was gone. I had me a great-nephew lived in upstate New York one time, she said easily to Mark Zellman. Town named Rouse's Point. Backed right up against Vermont on Lake Champlain, it is. Probably never heard of it, have you? Mark Zellman said he sure had heard of it. Just about everyone in New York State knew that town. Had he ever been there? His face broke tragically. No, he never had. Always meant to. From what Ronnie wrote in his letters, you didn't miss much, she said. And Zellman went away beaming broadly. The others came up to make their manners, as the other parties had done before them, as still others would do in the days and weeks to come. A teenage boy. A fellow named Jack Jackson, who was a car mechanic. A young RN named Laurie Constable. She would come in handy. An old man named Richard Ferris, whom everyone called the Judge. He looked at her keenly and almost made her feel uncomfortable again. And a great many others. She spoke to them all, nodded, smiled, and put them at their ease. But the pleasure she had felt on other days was gone today, and she felt only the aches in her wrists and fingers and knees, plus the gnawing suspicion that she had to go use the portisan, and if she didn't get there soon, she was going to stain her dress. All of that and the feeling, fading now, that she had missed something of great significance, and she might later be very sorry. Nick Andros sat in the study of the house on Baseline Drive that he shared with Ralph Brentner and Ralph's woman, Elise. It was almost dark. The house was a beauty, sitting below the bulk of Flagstaff Mountain, but quite a bit above the town of Boulder proper, so that from the wide living room window the streets and roads of the municipality appeared spread out like a gigantic game board. That window was treated on the outside with some sort of silvery reflective stuff, so that the squire could look out, but passers-by could not look in. Nick guessed that the house was in the $150,000 to $200,000 range, and the owner and his family were mysteriously absent. On his own long journey from Shoyo to Boulder, first by himself, then with Tom Cullen and the others, he had passed through tens of dozens of towns and cities, and all of them had been stinking charnel houses. Boulder had no business being any different, but it was. There were corpses here, yes, thousands of them, and something was going to have to be done about them before the hot, dry days ended and the fall rains began, causing quicker decomposition and possible disease. But there were not enough corpses. Nick wondered if anyone other than he and Stu Redman had noticed it. Lauder, maybe. Lauder noticed almost everything. For every house or public building you found littered with corpses, there were 10 others completely empty. Sometime during the last spasm of the plague, most of Boulder's citizens, sick or well, had blown town. Why? Well, he supposed it really didn't matter, and maybe they would never know. The awesome fact remained that Mother Abigail, sight unseen, had managed to lead them to maybe the one small city in the United States that had been cleared of plague victims. It was enough to make even an agnostic like himself wonder where she was getting her information. He went back to his thoughts, doodling formlessly on a pad in front of him. It seemed to him that all they wanted or needed from the old life was stored in the silent East Boulder power plant, like dusty treasure in a dark cupboard. An unpleasant feeling seemed to run through the people who had gathered in Boulder, a feeling just submerged below the surface. They were like a scared bunch of kids knocking around in the local haunted house after dark. There was a sense that being here in Boulder was strictly a temporary thing. There was one man, a fellow named Impening, who had lived in Boulder and worked on one of the custodial crews at the IBM plant out on the Boulder-Longmont diagonal. Impening seemed determined to stir up unrest. He was going around telling people that in 1974 there had been an inch and a half of snow in Boulder by September 14th, and that by November it would be cold enough to freeze the balls off a brass monkey. That was the kind of talk Nick would like to put a quick stop to. Never mind that if Impening had been in the army he would have been cashiered for such talk. That was an empty logic, if it was logic at all. The important thing was that Impening's words would have no power if people could move into houses where the lights worked and where the furnaces blew hot air up through grates at the touch of a finger on a button. If that didn't happen by the time the first cold snap arrived, Nick was afraid that people would begin to simply slip away, and all the meetings, representatives, and ratifications in the world wouldn't stop that. According to Ralph, there wasn't that much wrong at the power plant, at least not that much visible. The crews who ran it had shut some of the machinery down. Other machinery had shut itself down. Two or three of the big turbine engines had blown, perhaps as the result of some final power surge. Ralph said that some of the wiring would have to be replaced, but he thought that he and Brad Kitchener and a crew of a dozen warm bodies could do that. A much bigger work crew was needed to remove fused and blackened copper wire from the blown turbine generators and then install new copper wire by the yard. There was plenty of copper wire in the Denver supply houses for the taking. Ralph and Brad had gone one day last week to check for themselves. With the manpower, they thought they could have the lights on again by Labor Day. "And then we'll throw the biggest fucking party this town ever saw," Brad said. Law and order. That was something else that troubled him. Could Stu Redmond be handed that particular package? He wouldn't want the job, but Nick thought he could perhaps persuade Stu to take it. And if push came to shove, he could get Stu's friend Glenn to back him up. What really bothered him was the memory, still too fresh and hurtful to look at more than briefly, of his own brief and terrible tour as Shoyo's jailkeeper. Vince and Billy dying, Mike Childress jumping up and down on his supper and crying out in wretched defiance, "Hunger strike! I'm on a fucking hunger strike!" It made him ache inside to think they might need courts and jails. Christ, these were Mother Abigail's people, not the Dark Man's. But he suspected the Dark Man would not bother with such trivialities as courts and jails. His punishment would be swift and sure and heavy. He would not need the threat of jail when the corpses hung on the telephone pole crosses along I-15. Nick hoped most of the infractions would be small ones. There had been several cases of drunk and disorderly already. One kid, really too young to drive, had been riding a big dragging machine up and down Broadway, scaring people out of the street. He had finally driven into a stalled bread truck and had gashed his forehead. Unlucky to get off so cheaply, in Nick's opinion. The people who had seen him knew he was too young, but no one had felt he or she had the authority to put a stop to it. Authority. Organization. He wrote the words on his pad and put them inside a double circle. Being Mother Abigail's people gave them no immunity to weakness, stupidity, or bad companions. Nick didn't know if they were the children of God or not, but when Moses had come down from the mountain, those not busy worshipping the golden calf had been busy shooting craps, he knew that. And they had to face the possibility that someone might get cut over a card game, or decide to shoot someone else over a woman. Authority. Organization. He circled the words again, and now they were like prisoners behind a triple stockade. How well they went together, and what a sorry sound they made. Not long after, Ralph came in to show Nick a sample poster. Still smelling strongly of mimeograph ink, the print was large and eye-catching. Ralph had done the graphics himself. "Mass meeting. Representative board to be nominated and elected. 8:30 p.m. August 18th, 1980. Place, Canyon Boulevard Park in Bandshell, if fine. Chautauqua Hall in Chautauqua Park, if foul. Refreshments will be served following the meeting." Below this were two rudimentary street maps for newcomers and those who hadn't spent much time exploring Boulder. Below, in rather fine print, were the names he and Stu and Glenn had agreed upon after some discussion earlier in the day. Ad hoc committee. Nick Andros, Glenn Bateman, Ralph Brentner, Richard Ellis, Fran Goldsmith, Stuart Redman, Susan Stern. "Spent some time talking with the fellow in charge of that big group that came in today," Ralph said after Nick had nodded his approval and handed the flyer back. "Larry Underwood, his name is. Smart man, Nick. Sharp. He's 5 or 6 years older than you and maybe 5 years younger than Redmond. He's the kind of man you've been looking for. Wish we had room for him on this committee thing. You'd like him." Nick shrugged. It was too late now. He and the others had been finalizing the committee even as Larry and his party were meeting Mother Abigail. He pointed to the line on the flyer about refreshments and raised his eyebrows. "Oh, yeah, well, Franny came by and said we'd be more apt to get everybody if we had something. She and a friend there, Patty Kroger, they're going to see to it. Cookies and Zyrex." Ralph made a face. If it came down to a choice between drinking Zyrex and bull piss, I'd have to sit down and think her over. You can have mine, Nicky. Nick grinned. The only thing about this, Ralph went on more seriously, is you guys put me on this committee. I know what that word means. It means congratulations, you get to do all the hard work. Well, I don't really mind that. I've been working hard all my life. But committees are supposed to have ideas, and I ain't much of an idea man. On his pad, Nick quickly sketched a big CB setup, and in the background, a radio tower with bolts of electricity coming from its top. Yeah, but that's a lot different, Ralph said glumly. You'll be fine, Nick wrote. Believe it. If you say so, Nicky, I'll give her a try. I still think you'd be better off with this Underwood fella, though. Nick clapped Ralph on the shoulder. Ralph bid him good night and went upstairs. When he was gone, Nick looked thoughtfully at the handbill for a long time. If Stu and Glenn had seen copies, and he was sure they had by now, they knew that he had unilaterally stricken Harold Lauder's name from their list of ad hoc committee members. He didn't know how they might be taking it, but the fact that they hadn't shown up at his door yet was probably a good sign. They might want him to do some horse trading of his own, and if he had to, he would do it, just to keep Harold out at the top. If he had to, he would give them Ralph. Ralph didn't really want the position anyway, although, goddammit, Ralph had great native wit and the nearly priceless ability to think around the corners of problems. He would be a good man to have on the permanent committee, and he felt that Stu and Glenn had already packed the committee with their friends. If he wanted Lauder out, they would just have to go along. To pull off this leadership coup smoothly, there had to be no dissension at all among them, and they would have to be constantly thinking three steps ahead. After love, Stu had gone to sleep. He had been on short sleep rations lately, and the night before he had been up all night with Glenn Bateman, planning for the future. Franny had put on her robe and had come out here on the balcony. The building they lived in was downtown, on the corner of Pearl Street and Broadway. Their apartment was on the third floor, and below her she could see the intersection, Pearl running east-west, Broadway running north-south. She liked it here. They had the compass boxed. The night was warm and windless, the black stone of the sky flawed with a million stars. In their faint and frosty glow, Fran could see the slabs of the Flatirons rising in the west. She passed a hand down from her neck to her thighs. The dressing gown she wore was silk, and she was naked underneath. Her hand passed smoothly over her breasts, and then, instead of continuing on flat and straight to the mild rise of her pubis, her hand traced an arc of belly, following a curve that had not been this pronounced even 2 weeks ago. She was beginning to show, not a lot yet, but Stu had commented on it this evening. His question had been casual enough, even comic. How long can we do it without me, squeezing him? Or her, she had answered, amused. How does 4 months sound, Chief? Fine, he had answered, and slipped deliciously into her. Earlier, talk had been much more serious. Not long after they got to Boulder, Stu told her he had discussed the baby with Glenn, and Glenn had advanced the idea, very cautiously, that the superflu germ or virus might still be around. If so, the baby might die. It was an unsettling thought. You could always, she thought, count on Glenn Bateman for an unsettling thought or two. But surely if the mother was immune, the baby... Yet there were plenty of people here who had lost children to the plague. Yes, but that would mean... Would mean what? Well, for one thing, it might mean that all these people here were just an epilogue to the human race, a brief coda. She didn't want to believe that, couldn't believe it. If that were... Someone was coming up the street, turning sideways to slip between a dump truck that had stalled with two of its wheels on the pavement and the wall of a restaurant called the Pearl Street Kitchen. He had a light jacket slung over one shoulder and was carrying something in one hand that was either a bottle or a gun with a long barrel. In the other hand, he had a sheet of paper, probably with an address written on it from the way he was checking street numbers. At last, he stopped in front of their building. He was looking at the door and trying to decide what to do. Franny was standing less than 20 feet above his head, and she found herself in one of those situations. If she called to him, she might scare him. If she didn't, he might start knocking and wake Stuart up. And what was he doing with a gun in his hand anyway, if it was a gun? He suddenly craned his neck and looked up, probably to see if any lights were on. Franny was still looking down. They peered directly into each other's eyes. "Holy God!" the man on the sidewalk cried. He took an involuntary step backward, went off the sidewalk into the gutter, and sat down hard. "Oh!" Franny said at the same moment, and took her own step backward on the balcony. There was a spider plant in a large pottery vase on a pedestal behind her. Franny's behind struck it. It tottered, almost decided to live a little longer, and then defenestrated itself on the balcony's slate flags with a loud crash. In the bedroom, Stu grunted, turned over, and was still again. Franny, perhaps predictably, was seized with the giggles. She put both hands over her mouth and pinched viciously at her lips, but the giggles came out anyway in a series of hoarse little whispers. "Grace strikes again," she thought, and whisper giggled madly into her cupped hands. "If he'd had a guitar, I could have dropped the damn bass on his head." "O solo mio!" Crash! Her belly hurt from trying to hold in the giggles. A conspiratorial whisper wafted its way up from below. "Hey, you! You on the balcony! Psst!" "Psst!" Franny whispered to herself. "Psst! Oh, great!" She had to get out before she started hee-hawing away like a donkey. She had never been able to hold in her laughter once it got hold of her. She ran fleetly across the darkened bedroom, snatched a more substantial and demure wrapper from the back of the bathroom door, and went down the hall struggling it on, her face working like a rubber mask. She let herself out onto the landing and got down one flight before the laughter escaped her and flew free. She went down the lower two flights, laughing wildly. The man, a young man, she now saw, had picked himself up and was brushing himself off. He was slim and well-built, most of his face covered with a beard that might be blonde or possibly sandy red by daylight. There were dark circles under his eyes, but he was smiling a rueful little smile. "What did you knock over?" he asked. "It sounded like a piano." "It was a vase," she said. It... But then the giggles caught her again, and she could only point a finger at him and laugh quietly and shake her head, and then hold her aching belly again. Tears rolled down her cheeks. "You really looked funny. I know that's a hell of a thing to say to somebody you just met, but, oh my, you did." "If this was the old days," he said, grinning, "my act would be to sue you for at least a quarter of a million. Whiplash. Judge, I looked up and this young woman was peering down at me. Yes, I believe she was making a face. Her face was on, at any rate. We fine for the plaintiff, this poor boy, also for the bailiff. There will be a 10-minute recess." They laughed together a little. The young man was wearing clean, faded jeans and a dark blue shirt. The summer night was warm and kind, and Franny was beginning to be glad she had come out. "Your name wouldn't happen to be Fran Goldsmith, would it?"
"It so happens, but I don't know you."
"Larry Underwood, we just came in today. Actually, I was looking for a fellow named Harold Lauder. They said he was living at 261 Pearl along with Stuart Redman and Franny Goldsmith and some other people." That dried her giggles up. "Harold was in the building when we first got to Boulder, but he split quite a while ago. He's on Arapahoe now, on the west side of town. I can give you his address if you want it, and directions." "I'd appreciate that, but I'll wait until tomorrow to go over, I guess. I'm not risking this action again."
"Do you know Harold?"
she asked.
"I do and I don't," Larry said. "The same way I do and don't know you. Although I have to be honest and say you don't look the way I pictured you. In my mind, I saw you as a Valkyrie-type blonde right out of a Frank Frazetta painting, probably with a 45 on each hip. But I'm pleased to meet you anyway."
He stuck out his hand, and Franny shook it with a bewildered little smile.
"I'm not getting you.
Sit down on the curb a minute, and I'll tell you." She sat. A ghost of a breeze riffled up the street, shuffling scraps of paper and making the old elms move on the courthouse lawn. He held up the long-barreled gun, and it wasn't a gun at all. It was a wine bottle with a long neck. She tilted the label to the starlight and could just barely read the large print. Bordeaux at the top, and at the bottom the date, 1947. "The best vintage Bordeaux in this century," he said. "At least that's what an old friend of mine used to say. His name was Rudy, God love his soul."
"That's for Harold?"
"That and something else," he said. He took something out of his jacket pocket and handed it to her. She didn't have to turn this up to the starlight to read the print, large orange letters outlined with blue. She burst out laughing.
"A payday candy bar," she exclaimed. "Harold's... But how would you know that?"
"That's the story."
"Then tell me."
"Well then, once upon a time there was a fellow named Larry Underwood, who for various reasons had to leave California in a hurry. He came to New York where his mother lived, and behold, the Wicked Witch of the West, or some Pentagon assholes, visited the country with a great plague, and before you could say, 'Here comes Captain Trips,' just about everyone in New York was dead. Now, Larry was one of the lucky ones. He made it out of the city with a lady named Rita, who wasn't very well equipped to deal with what had happened. And unfortunately, Larry wasn't very well equipped to help her deal with it. No one had the equipment, but some developed it quicker than others. Anyhow, Larry and Rita headed for the coast of Maine. They made it as far as Vermont, and the lady OD'd on sleeping pills."
"Oh, Larry, that is too bad."
"Larry took it very personally. In fact, he took it as a personal judgment on his strength of character. In fact, he had been told by one or two people who should have known that his most incorruptible character trait was a splendid streak of self-interest, which came shining through like a day-glow Madonna sitting on the dashboard of a 59 Cadillac." Franny shifted a bit on the curb. "I hope I'm not making you uncomfortable, but all of this has been sloshing around inside for a long time. Larry continued on to Maine because there didn't seem to be any place else to go. He was having very bad dreams by then, but since he was alone, he had no way of knowing that other people were having them too. He simply assumed it was another symptom of his continuing mental breakdown. But eventually he made it to a small coastal town named Wells, where he met a woman named Nadine Cross and a boy whose name turns out to be Leo Rockway."
"Wells," she marveled softly.
"Anyway, the three travelers sort of flipped a coin to see which way they should head on US-1, and since it came up tails, they headed down south, where they eventually came to..."
"A gunquit," Franny said, delighted.
"Just so. There on a barn in huge letters, I made my first acquaintance with Harold Lauder and Francis Goldsmith."
"Harold's sign! Oh, Larry, he will be pleased!"
"We followed the directions on the barn to Stovington, and the directions at Stovington to Nebraska, and the directions at Mother Abigail's house to Boulder. We met people along the way. One of them was a girl named Lucy Swan, who's my woman. I'd like you to meet her sometime. I think you'd like her." By then, something had happened that Larry didn't really want. His little party of four grew to six. The six met four more in upstate New York, and our party absorbed theirs. By the time we made it to Harold's sign in Mother Abigail's dooryard, there were 16 of us, and we picked up another three just as we were leaving. Larry was in charge of this brave band. There was no vote or anything like that, it just was. And he really didn't want the responsibility. It was a drag, it was keeping him awake nights. He started popping Tums and Rolaids. But it's funny the way your mind boxes your mind. I couldn't let it go. And he was always afraid he was going to fuck it up righteously, and that he'd get up some morning and someone would be dead in their sleeping bag the way Rita was that time in Vermont, and everyone would be standing around pointing their fingers and saying, "It's your fault. You didn't know any better, and it's your fault." And that was something I couldn't talk about, not even to the judge.
"Who's the judge?"
"Judge Ferris, an old guy from Peoria. I guess he really was a judge at one time back in the early 50s, circuit judge or something, but he'd been retired a long time when the flu hit. He's plenty sharp, though. When he looks at you, you'd swear he has X-ray eyes. Anyhow, Harold was important to me. He got to be more important as there got to be more people. In direct ratio, you might say." He chuckled a little. "That barn. Man, the last line of that sign, the one with your name, was so low I figured he really must have been hanging ass out to the wind when he painted it on." "Yes, I was sleeping when he did that. I would have made him stop."
"I started to get a sense of him," Larry said. "I found a payday wrapper in the cupola of that barn in a gunquit, and then the carving on the beam."
"What carving?" She felt that Larry was studying her in the dark, and she pulled her robe a little closer around her. Not a gesture of modesty, because she felt no threat from this man, but one of nervousness.
"Just his initials," Larry said casually.
"H-E-L. If that had been the end of it, I wouldn't be here now. But then at the motorcycle dealership in Wells, we were there."
"I know you were. I saw a couple of bikes gone."
What made an even bigger impression was that Harold had siphoned some gas from the underground tank.
"You must have helped him, Fran. I damn near lost my fingers."
"No, I didn't have to.
Harold hunted around until he found something he called a plug vent. Larry groaned and slapped his forehead. Plug vent? Jesus, I never even looked for where they were venting the tank. You mean he just hunted around, pulled a plug, and put his hose in? Well, yes. Oh, Harold, Larry said in a tone of admiration that she had never heard before, at least not in connection with Harold Lauder's name. Well, that's one of his tricks I missed. Anyway, we got to Stovington, and the dean was so upset she fainted. I cried, Fran said. I bawled until it seemed I'd never stop. I just had my mind made up that when we got there, someone would welcome us in and say, "Hi, step right inside. Cafeteria's on your left." She shook her head. That seems so silly now. I was not dismayed. Dauntless Harold had been there before me, left his sign, and gone on. I felt like a tenderfoot Easterner following that Indian from the Pathfinder. His view of Harold both fascinated and amazed her. Hadn't Stu really been leading the party by the time they left Vermont and struck out for Nebraska? She couldn't honestly remember. By then, they had all been preoccupied with the dreams. Larry was reminding her of things she had forgotten, or worse, had taken for granted. Harold risking his life to put that sign on the barn, it had seemed like a foolish risk to her, but it had done some good after all. And getting gas from that underground tank. It had apparently been a major operation for Larry, but Harold had seemed to take it purely as a matter of course. It made her feel small, and it made her feel guilty. They all more or less assumed that Harold was nothing but a grinning supernumerary. But Harold had turned quite a few tricks in the last 6 weeks. Had she been so much in love with Stu that it took this total stranger to point out some home truths about Harold? What made the feeling even more uncomfortable was the fact that, once he had gotten his feet under him, Harold had been completely adult about herself and Stuart. Larry said, "So, here's another neat sign, complete with route numbers, at Stovington, right?" And fluttering in the grass next to it, another payday candy wrapper. I felt like instead of following broken sticks and bent grasses, I was following Harold's trail of paydays. "Well, we didn't follow your route the whole way. We bent north near Gary, Indiana, because there was one hell of a fire, still burning in places. It looked like every damn oil tank in the city went up. Anyhow, we picked up the judge on the detour. Stopped by Hemingford home. We knew she was gone by then, the dreams, you know, but we all wanted to see that place just the same. The corn, tire swing. You know what I mean?" "Yes," Franny said quietly. "Yes, I do." "And all the time I'm going crazy thinking that something is going to happen. We're going to get attacked by a motorcycle gang or something, run out of water, I don't know. There used to be a book my mom had. She got it from her grandmother or something. In His Steps, that was the name of it. And there were all these little stories about guys with horrible problems, ethical problems, most of them. And the guy who wrote the book said that to solve the problems, all you had to do was ask, 'What would Jesus do?' It always cleared the trouble right up. You know what I think? It's a Zen question. Not really a question at all, but a way to clear your mind, like saying Om and looking at the tip of your nose. So when I really started to get wound up, Lucy... That's my girl, did I tell you? Lucy would say, 'Hurry up, Larry, ask the question.'" "What would Jesus do?" Fran said, amused. "No, what would Harold do?" Larry answered seriously. Fran was nearly dumbfounded. She could not help wishing to be around when Larry actually met Harold. Whatever in the world would his reaction be? We camped in this farmyard one night, and we were really almost out of water. The place had a well, but no way of drawing it up, naturally, because the power was off and the pump wouldn't work. And Leo kept walking by and saying, 'Firsty, Larry, putty firsty now,' and he was driving me bug shit. I could feel myself tightening up, and the next time he came by, I probably would have hit him. Nice guy, huh? Getting ready to hit a disturbed child. But a person can't change all at once. I've had plenty of time to work that out for myself." "I'd say you've done pretty well," Fran murmured. "Harold and I did pretty well," he corrected. "Anyway, Lucy said, 'Quick, Larry, ask the question.' So I did. There was a windmill on the place that ran water up to the barn. It was turning pretty good, but there wasn't any water coming out of the barn faucets either. So I opened the big case at the foot of the windmill, where all the machinery was, and I saw that the main drive shaft had popped out of its hole. I got it back in, and bingo, all the water you could want, thanks to Harold.
Thanks to you? Harold wasn't really there, Larry.
Well, he was in my head, and now I'm here, and I brought him the wine and the candy bars.
He didn't say anything for a long time, but she felt him looking at her. At last he said,
"Okay, how have I got it wrong about Harold?"
She stood up.
"I ought to go in now. It's been nice to meet you, Larry. Come by tomorrow and meet Stu. Bring your Lucy if she's not busy."
"What is it about him?" he insisted, standing with her.
"Oh, I don't know," she said thickly.
Suddenly the tears were very close.
"You make me feel as if I treated Harold very shabbily, and I don't know why or how I did it. Can I be blamed for not loving him the way I do, Stu? Is that supposed to be my fault?"
"No, of course not." Larry looked taken aback.
Listen, I'm sorry. I barged in on you. I'll go."
"He's changed," Franny burst out. "I don't know how or why, and sometimes I think it might be for the better, but I don't really know, and sometimes I'm afraid."
"Afraid of Harold?"
She didn't answer, only looked down at her feet. She thought she had already said too much.
"You were going to tell me how I could get there," he asked gently.
"It's easy. Just go straight out Arapahoe until you come to the little park, the Evan G. Fine Park, I think it is. The park's on the right. Harold's little house is on the left, just across from it."
"All right. Thanks. Meeting you was a pleasure, Fran, busted base and all."
She smiled, but it was perfunctory. All of the dizzy good humor had gone out of the evening. Larry raised the bottle of wine and offered his slanted little smile. "And if you see him before I do, keep a secret, huh?"
"Sure.
Night, Franny." He walked back the way he had come. She watched him out of sight, then went upstairs and slipped into bed next to Stu, who was still out like a light. "Harold," she thought, pulling the covers up to her chin. How was she supposed to tell this Larry that Harold Lauder was fat and juvenile and lost himself? Was she supposed to tell him that the sometimes sulky, often frightened Harold that had come to Boulder from Ogunquit had turned into a stout politician, a backslapper, a hail fellow well met type of guy who nonetheless looked at you with the flat and unsmiling eyes of a Gila monster? She thought her wait for sleep might be very long tonight. Harold had fallen hopelessly in love with her, and she had fallen hopelessly in love with Stu Redman, and it certainly was a tough old world. And now every time I see Harold, I get such a case of the creeps. Even though he looks like he's lost 10 pounds or so, and he doesn't have quite so many pimples, I get that... Her breath caught audibly in her throat, and she sat up on her elbows, eyes wide in the dark. Something had moved inside her. Her hands went to the slight swelling of her middle. Surely it was too early. It had only been her imagination, except it hadn't been. She lay back down slowly, her heart beating hard. She almost woke Stu up and then didn't. If only he had put the baby inside her instead of Jess. If he had, she would have awakened him and shared the moment with him. And then the movement came again, so slight it might only have been gas. Except she knew better. It was the baby. The baby was alive. "Oh, glory," she murmured to herself, and lay back. Larry Underwood and Harold Lauder were forgotten. Everything that had happened to her since her mother had fallen ill was forgotten. She waited for it to move again, listening for that presence inside herself, and fell asleep still listening. Her baby was alive. Harold sat in a chair on the lawn of the little house he had picked out for himself, looking up at the sky and thinking of an old rock and roll song. He hated rock, but he could remember this one almost line for line, and even the name of the group that had sung it, Kathy Young and the Innocents. The lead singer, songstress, whatever, had a high, yearning, reedy voice that had somehow caught his full attention. A golden goody, the DJs called it. The girl singing lead sounded 16 years old, pallid, blonde, and plain. She sounded as if she might be singing to a picture that spent most of its time buried in a dresser drawer, a picture that was taken out only late at night when everyone else was asleep.
She sounded hopeless. The picture she sang to had perhaps been clipped from her big sister's yearbook. A picture of the local big jock, captain of the football team and president of the student council. The big jock would be slipping it to the head cheerleader on some deserted lover's lane, while far away in suburbia this plain girl with no breasts and a pimple in the corner of her mouth sang, "A thousand stars in the sky make me realize you are the one that I'll adore. Tell me you love me. Tell me you're mine, all mine." There were a lot more than 1,000 stars in his sky tonight, but they weren't lover's stars. No soft call of Milky Way here. Here, a mile above sea level, they were as sharp and cruel as a billion holes in black velvet. A piece of black velvet with some unknowable light shining behind it. They were haters' stars, and because they were, Harold felt well qualified to wish on them. Wish I may, wish I might, have the wish I wish tonight. Harold's hair was longer than ever, but it was no longer dirty and clotted and tangled. He no longer smelled like a shoot-off in a haymow. Even his blemishes were clearing up, now that he had laid off the candy. And with the hard work and all the walking, he was losing some weight. He was starting to look pretty good. He shifted in his chair. There was a book in his lap, a tall volume with a marbled blue binding and imitation leather covers. He kept it hidden under a loose hearthstone in the house when he was away. If anyone found the book, that would be the end of him in Boulder. There was one word stamped in gold leaf on the book's cover, and the word was ledger. It was the journal he had started after reading Fran's diary. Already he had filled the first 60 pages with his close, margin-to-margin handwriting. There were no paragraphs, only a solid block of writing, an outpouring of hate like pus from a skin abscess. He hadn't thought he had so much hate in him. It seemed he should have exhausted the flow by now, yet it seemed he had only tapped it. It was like that old joke. Why was the ground all white after Custer's last stand? Because the Indians kept coming and coming and... And why did he hate? That was a hard question to answer, except maybe to a few, a chosen few. Hadn't Einstein said there were only 6 people in the world who understood all the implications of E equals MC squared? What about the equation inside his own skull? The relativity of Harold? The speed of blight? Oh, he could fill twice as many pages as he had already written about that, becoming more obscure, more arcane, until he finally became lost in the clockwork of himself and still nowhere near the mainspring at all. He was, perhaps, raping himself. Was that it? It was close, anyway. An obscene and ongoing act of buggery. The Indians just kept on coming and coming. He would be leaving Boulder soon anyway. A month or two, no more. When he finally settled on a method of settling his scores, then he would head out west. And when he got there, he would open his mouth and spill his guts about this place. He would tell them what went on at the public meetings, and much more important, what went on at the private meetings. He was sure to be on the Free Zone Committee. He would be well rewarded by the fellow in charge over there, not by an end to hate, but by the perfect vehicle for it, a hate Cadillac, a fear Dorado, long and darkly shining. He would climb into it, and it would bear him and his hate down on them. He and Flagg would kick this miserable settlement apart like an anthill. But first he would settle with Redmond, who had lied to him and stolen his woman. "Yes, Harold, but why do you hate?" There had been a time, an hour or an instant, when he had contemplated jettisoning the hate. That had been after he had finished reading Fran's diary and discovered she was irrevocably committed to Stu Redmond. That sudden knowledge had acted upon him the way a dash of cold water acts on a slug, causing it to contract into a tight little ball instead of a spread-out, loosely questing organism. In that hour or instant, he became aware that he could simply accept what was. That knowledge had both exhilarated and terrified him. For that space of time, he knew he could turn himself into a new person, a fresh Harold Lauder cloned from the old one by the sharp intervening knife of the superflu epidemic. He sensed, more clearly than any of the others, that that was what the Boulder Free Zone was all about. People were not the same. This small-town society was like no other in American pre-plague society. They didn't see it because they didn't stand outside the boundaries as he did. Men and women were living together with no apparent desire to reinstitute the ceremony of marriage. Whole groups of people were living together in small sub-communities like communes, There wasn't much fighting. People seemed to be getting along. And strangest of all, none of them seemed to be questioning the profound theological implications of the dreams, and of the plague itself. Boulder itself was a cloned society, a tabula so rasa that it could not sense its own novel beauty. Harold sensed it, and hated it. Far away over the mountains was another cloned creature, a cutting from the dark malignancy, a single wild cell taken from the dying corpus of the old body politic, a lone representative of the carcinoma that had been eating the old society alive. One single cell, but it had already begun to reproduce itself and spawn other wild cells. For society, it would be the old struggle, the effort of healthy tissue to reject the malignant incursion. But for each individual cell, there was the old, old question, the one that went back to the garden, that of free will. Over there in the West, all the old hates and fears were spawning themselves. The assassins of Eden were there, the dark fusiliers. And he himself, when faced with the knowledge that he was free to accept what was, had, of his own free will, rejected the new opportunity. To seize it would have been to murder himself. The ghost of every humiliation he had ever suffered cried out against it. His murdered dreams and ambitions came back to eldritch life and asked if he could forget them so easily. In the new free zone society, he could only be Harold Lauder citizen. Over there, he could be a prince. The malignancy drew him. It was a dark carnival, Ferris wheels with their lights out revolving above a black landscape, a never-ending sideshow filled with freaks like himself, and in the main tent, the lions ate the spectators. What called him was this discordant music of chaos. He opened his journal and by starlight wrote firmly.